Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So continuing on with Thanajan Jeff's explanation of the structure of breath meditation. He's going into more about the second and third tetrad, and particularly focusing on rapture and gladdening the mind. So I thought I would sprinkle the readings with some things to try to help gladden the mind. So I'll start with just a couple of verses from Lama Tsongkhapa, the Lam Rim. This opportune physical form is worth more than a wish-granting gem. You only gain its like the once, so hard to get, so easily destroyed, it's like a lightning bolt in the sky. Contemplate this and you will realize all worldly actions are but winnowed chaff, and night and day you must extract some essence from your life. I, the yogi, practice this way. You, wanting liberation, do the same. Continuing on. The second tetrad, being sensitive to rapture, sensitive to pleasure, sensitive to mental fabrication, i.e. perception and feeling, and calming mental fabrication, describes the progress from the early stages of meditation up through the cessation of perception and feeling. Rapture is present in the first two jhanas, pleasure in the first three. Perception plays a role in all the meditative attainments up through the dimension of nothingness. As you go through these levels, the underlying perception grows more refined. Similarly with feelings, from the rapture and pleasure of the first two jhanas, feelings grow more refined through the equanimous pleasure of the third, and then to the pure equanimity of the fourth, which forms a foundation for the next four formless attainments. Finally, the total calming of perception and feeling occurs with the cessation of perception and feeling, the ninth attainment. The question arises, if verbal fabrication ceases with the second jhana and the breath with the fourth, how can any of the 16 steps apply to those attainments or to any of the higher levels of concentration? After all of the steps are done in conjunction with breathing, and steps 3 through 16 employ verbal fabrication in the act of training. The answer is that even though these forms of fabrication are not present in the higher levels of concentration, the mind will sometimes have to make a deliberate choice when moving from one attainment to the next. This will require a moment of reflection in which you step back from your full focus before plunging in again. Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Fives, Sutta 28, illustrates this process with the image of a person standing, watching a person sitting down, or a person sitting, watching a person lying down. Verbal and bodily fabrication will resume during those moments of choice, which means that any of the 16 steps could also be applied during those moments. Any questions? The third tetrad, becoming sensitive to the mind, gladdening it, steadying it, and releasing it, covers all the stages of training the mind. Gladdening the mind begins with the preliminary practices of practicing generosity, observing the precepts, and abandoning the hindrances, practices that give rise to a sense of well-being and joy that can induce the mind to settle down in concentration. The gladdening grows more refined as the mind progresses through the first three jhanas, experiencing rapture and pleasure. It culminates in the joy that accompanies the attainment of the goal. Steadying the mind is also a process of progressive refinement up through the cessation of perception and feeling. Although each level of jhana and each formless attainment grows increasingly steady as you go up the series, only the levels beginning with the fourth jhana are said to be imperturbable. Likewise, releasing the mind is a progressive process. you release the mind at least temporarily from the affliction of attending to perceptions of sensuality on entering the first jhana, from the affliction of attending to perceptions of directed thought on entering the second jhana, and so on, up through the cessation of perception and feeling. Finally, release becomes total on reaching unbinding. And that's the third tetrad, again, Ajahn Jeff's explanation of it, so let's just see if there's any questions on that before going on to the fourth. Comments?
Maybe a question. It just seems like, you know, with all the first three so far, he's really focusing, as they're applied to jhana, very high states of concentration. And I don't know, it just seems to me like there's kind of something missing in terms of how they can be so useful in a more, in, you know, a more mundane kind of application. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I think the, yeah, I mean, that's the, he's explaining about the kind of, the kind of the pinnacle of refinement.
Yeah.
That probably is most of our experience.
Because it starts with first jhana.
But the, I think all of those factors stages of the different tetrads are applicable on your, because you're trying to refine the mind anyway, so that say just bringing up wholesome dhammas, relinquishing unwholesome dhammas, trying to settle and stabilize the object of meditation, so that those are investigative processes as well, in the sense of just investigating something like the. Because there's all sorts of, you know, when bhiti is defined much more in the commentaries, I think, that it's defined more clearly. There's five levels of bhiti, and you know, going from pretty ordinary bhiti, that a joy, rapture that everybody experiences, up to, you know, quite dramatic expression of rapture, so that those are, you know, one can be investigating that, or the investigation of the are being sensitive to citta sankhara, you know, whether the mind's in jhana or not jhana, citta sankhara happening all the time. You got to figure it out. You've got to pay attention to it, or that sense of sensitive to or experiencing the citta. It isn't necessarily a jhana practice. It's a cultivation of mindfulness and discernment. And it isn't until one has laid that foundation of understanding and experience that one can even begin to approach the jhanas, so that the anapanasati is laying those foundations of mindfulness and discernment right from the get-go. One's waiting for jhana to happen so you can practice anapanasati.
Hopefully the microphone can pick up for Matt.
Just in case there's any concern of the greater audience out there.
Maybe when it's edited, it can be. reading I chose from Ajahn Mahabhua talks along those lines,
uh-huh,
as well. That's good. One of the reasons I wanted to add in those readings.
Just a second, what are you in a question?
I was just going to add a comment that I had actually written to Ajahn Jeff concerning this point.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote me back a very nice letter saying it's possible to get tastes of these sort of expanded states,
mm-hmm.
but not to neglect the experience that the body can give you, because you need to learn the processes of denial and self-delusion that the body will show to you
mm-hmm.
in meditation.
Yeah.
So I just want to throw that into the...
Yeah, I think that's that. Because Ajahn Jeff is, he's another body person. You know, the importance of including and relying on the experience within the body as one develops the whole path, and particularly the Anapanasati. And even particularly jhana. It's not a, he's a real proponent to recognize the bodily experience within the refinement of the,
yeah.
of peace and,
yeah.
and tranquility. And that's because there are kind of proponents that basically sort of, you know, in order to really access the jhanas, and you've got to be able to relinquish the experience of the body, which isn't one. I mean, Ajahn Jeff doesn't propound, he's not a proponent of that, and he points out over and over again how the Buddha himself illustrates and speaks of the experience of all being grounded in the experience of the body. So, yeah. I think it's helpful to ask him questions, because when he writes it can be pretty dense, and when he's asked, I think he forgets sometimes that people don't function at his level. But then when there's a direct question, he is very good at explaining and drawing it out.
So now I'll just read this brief rehashing of the fourth tetrad that he has, and then I'll go into some readings from Ajahn Mahabua and Lungpor Ban, see what we have time for. The fourth tetrad, remaining focused on inconstancy, dispassion, cessation, and relinquishing, is, like releasing the mind, a process that develops through progressive levels of refinement while mastering concentration, and then goes beyond refinement with the attainment of total unbinding. When you're trying to master concentration, you direct these contemplations to any object that would distract you from your theme. In other words, you focus these contemplations on anything that would provoke greed and distress with reference to the world outside of your concentration, seeing the distraction as composed of events, dhammas, that are inherently unworthy of attachment. In this way, you wean the mind from the distraction. I kind of like that phrase. They're inherently unworthy of my attachment. So this is from a short reading, just a couple paragraphs from Ajahn Mahabua, Forest Desanas, Volume 1, page 52. The reason why the mind cannot be calm is because of the agitating and disturbing influences that reside inside the mind. If the practitioner doesn't reflect on their harm, then they will not be able to find anything worthwhile. The wonderful quality of the mind, which is the state of calm, will not appear. We have to constantly see them as harmful and be very careful and vigilant. If we are not, how can we expect to come across the Magga, Pala, that's the path and fruit, and Nibbana? If they constantly obstruct Magga, Pala, and Nibbana, how can we ever realize them every time we think? Our thoughts always go in the way of the kilesa, the defilements. Whatever we concoct or turn our mind to various thoughts, it's never about the Dhamma, but always about the kilesas, about tanha and asava, that's craving and outflows. How then can we ever come across Magga, Pala, and Nibbana? We as practitioners must think like this. The kilesas are always influencing sankhara and sanya. As far as the sight and sound and other sense objects are concerned, the kilesa only influence them when they come into contact with the sense organs. This happens from time to time. It is the feelings and emotions which arise from sensual contacts that disturb and agitate us that we ceaselessly think about and concoct. Whatever we concoct, it is always the work of the kilesa, not the work of Dhamma, not the work of sati and panya. If panya investigates and contemplates, then it is the work of Dhamma. When sankhara thinks with Dhamma, analyzing and differentiating the element aggregates, reflecting and contemplating with discernment, then it will go in the way of Dhamma. Our perception, or sanya, must follow the investigation, like following a painted line. This is what sanya has to do. Then it will be in accordance with the Dhamma. But as it is, 95% of the time it's the work of the kilesa. Even the remaining 5% hardly ever goes the way of Dhamma. Thus, in the practice of Dhamma, we hardly ever come across and clearly perceive the Dhamma within our heart, the state of calm that is not really that far away from us at all. As soon as we curb and restrain our emotions with sati, the state of calm will appear. If we cannot calm our hearts and free them from these disturbing and agitating influences, how then are we going to come up with the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana? I have explained this to you countless times, more frequently than the kilesas have swarmed over your heart. By now you should be able to bear it in mind and take it up for contemplation and investigation. I like that because he pretty clearly defines what panya, the difference between panya and just regular old thinking based on defilement, on greed, hatred, and delusion. When panya, if panya investigates and contemplates, then it's the work of Dhamma. And then saying when sankhara thinks with Dhamma, so it's clear sankhara, mindfulness is a sankhara, even wisdom being a sankhara, analyzing and differentiating the element aggregates, reflecting and contemplating with discernment. So I thought that was a nice description of panya. Questions, comments? I just had some brief excerpts, I guess, from some Lungpur Ban talks, and this is an unpublished piece. It's from a talk, two talks of Lungpur Ban's called one talk called Studying the Nature of the Heart and another talk called The Middle Way. And I'll just read a few of these verses. Someone who's let go of it all, where do they live? They live in the heart that has let go. Having let go of everything, where does one abide? The heart of letting go is the abiding. When the mind's at ease, meditate a lot. When the mind's not at ease, meditate a lot. When the mind is peaceful, meditate a lot. When the mind's not peaceful, meditate a lot. To have bhavana, that's a mental cultivation, to have bhavana that continually goes well the entire time, this is impossible. At times it goes well, at times it goes poorly. It has to be this way. This is normal for meditators everywhere. It's just like traveling. To have a journey that's continually smooth with cool shade, always comfortable and carefree, is, in this world at least, non-existent. Though it's cool in those places where a breeze wafts through the midst of a refreshing and quiescent grove, once the weather heats up or the shade disappears, one feels scorched. Sometimes the terrain is rough with potholes. Other times there are floods. Sometimes there's an exposed pipe for us to trip over. It's natural that bhavana encounters these. What we're referring to when we talk about effort is the effort that spurs us on each step of the way. Not just when bhavana is going well. When bhavana isn't going well, effort means not getting discouraged, not giving up. That's taking a step in the direction of good bhavana. Whether the mind is peaceful or unpeaceful, develop bhavana intensely and consistently. How can an unpeaceful mind contemplate an unpeaceful mind? Our tireless striving for the goal has to be great enough. Only then. Rely on determination. Unabandoned determination. Unremitting determination. When contemplation is persistently steadfast, things begin to clear. Discerning clarity arises. Coolness arises. Peace arises in the heart. You don't have to wish for peace. It's like cooking food. You don't have to wish for cooked food. Put your heart into seeing that there's enough to heat, there's enough heat, and the heat is even and consistent. Then the food becomes cooked. So, leave that there. If there's any comments, questions.
Annyam tam gataya sadu kalam tatamase